The Iowa Art Showcase is Iowa Public Radio's monthly performing arts program devoted to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. For April, we'll delve into faces of Iowa State's Artists in Residence Project. IPR's Tony Daner will investigate the incredible offerings of this year's Mission Creek Festival. We'll get the inside scoop on the University of Iowa's upcoming production of Gilbert and Sullivan's Pirates of Penzance. And we'll hear about the University of Iowa Main Library's Rare Dada exhibit. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase. Thanks for joining us. Continuing now through April 28th, the University of Iowa Main Library Gallery is exhibiting their Documenting Dada, Disseminating Dada exhibit. Dr. Tim Scheip, curator of the International Dada Archive at the University of Iowa Libraries Special Collections, fills us in on the library's unique Dada collection and how Dada originated.
Dada was a literary and artistic movement that developed initially as a reaction to the First World War. It started in Switzerland, which was kind of a neutral haven in the midst of this massive slaughterhouse that Europe had become. And Zurich, the largest city in particular, had become a gathering place for all sorts of people who were seeking refuge from the war. You had revolutionaries and draft dodgers, poets, painters from countries on all sides of the conflict. Lenin was there plotting the revolution. James Joyce was there writing Ulysses. So in February 1916, a group of writers and performers, mostly from Germany, along with several students from Romania and various artistic types from different countries, started a performance space they called the Cabaret Voltaire. And it's really hard to describe what went on at the Cabaret Voltaire. It was such an eclectic variety of acts. There were musical performances ranging from classical piano works to a Russian balalaika orchestra to cabaret songs. There were poetry readings in numerous languages, or sometimes in several languages spoken simultaneously, or even in no language at all. They read manifestos, they displayed modern art, works on the walls. There was modern dance, just about anything you can imagine. And within a couple of months, they were calling this thing they were doing Dada, which is an incredibly evocative nonsense word. Dada means hobby horse in French. It means yes, yes in Romanian and Russian. It was the name of a hair product sold in Zurich at the time. And of course, it's often one of the first words spoken by infants. So as the war ended, then this Dada movement spread beyond Zurich, took root especially in Paris, which was, of course, the world capital of art at the time, and in Berlin, which was totally engulfed in this chaotic period of revolution and civil war after the German surrender. But it also sprouted branches in places like the Netherlands, Yugoslavia, US, Japan. But wherever it spread, I think it was all about performance. That's the key. The Dadaists painted and they sculpted. They wrote poetry and fiction and so on. But the essence of Dada was action. It was performance.
And it was more than just a movement.
Yeah, there was actually considerable argument among the Dadaists about whether Dada should be considered an art movement at all. But it's clear that the Dadaists weren't just interested in establishing another one of the long line of isms. There was Cubism, Expressionism, Futurism, and so forth, that had been defining European art history and literary history since the mid-19th century. They didn't just want to change art. They really wanted to change the culture and the civilization. They wanted to break down the aspects of civilization, especially Western civilization, that they believed had given rise to this horrific world war. They wanted to tear down artistic conventions. They wanted to break down the boundaries that separated the arts, music, literature, visual arts. And they wanted to break down the borders that separated the warring nations. They even wanted to demolished the language they felt had been corrupted and misused for propaganda to promote the war. So, like, in their sound poems, they would break language down to its most basic elements, to its sounds, and they engaged in direct action. They would confront their audience, insult their audience, and if their audience threw tomatoes at them, that was great. They, you know, they didn't want passive listeners and readers. And they took their actions even beyond the stage into the public arena. For example, they disrupted the German National Assembly. So in a way, they were precursors to styles of political protest that came to the fore in the 60s, guerrilla theater and the like. It was protest, but with a strong dose of humor.
So how exactly did you get hooked on this movement?
I think I first heard about it in a sixth grade art class trip to the Philadelphia Museum of Art, where we were taken to see their Arensberg collection, among other things. And it has the world's biggest collection of Marcel Duchamp and a lot of other Dada-related works. And that was where I first really heard the term Dada. And then I really didn't think much about it for another several decades until the university got a grant to start a Dada archive, and it was suggested that I might work in the archive, and I've been hooked ever since that.
So tell us about the University of Iowa and how they have come to house one of the world's largest collections.
First of all, yeah, you know, we're not really collecting artworks in the sense of paintings and sculptures. You know, it's a library collection, so what we have gathered is published documentation of the Dada movement. And I think it really started back in the 60s and 70s with two librarians at the university, Harlan Sifford and Frank Hanlon, who had the foresight and interest to acquire some important Dada works for the library, you know, when they were still easily available. It was just before a major surge in the market and interest among collectors. So then when a major conference and exhibition was held at Iowa in 1978 on Dada, we already had a substantial collection of rare Dada documents. And the idea of a Dada archive grew out of that 1978 conference. And because there was a strong research and teaching interest in Dada here, and because we already had the basis of a substantial collection, Iowa became the logical place to establish the archive. So Dada has been one of our collecting strengths ever since, and we've gradually built up quite a comprehensive gathering of material. And, you know, not just rare original documents and special collections. You know, we've also systematically collected the secondary literature, new editions, exhibition catalogs, and the like. These are all available in our circulating collections in the main library and the art library.
So tell us, what can folks see and what are some of your favorites in this show that you have put together?
It's a funny thing trying to do a library exhibition about Dada, because Dada was based so much on performance and ephemeral actions. You know, it's really hard to capture its essence in an exhibition of objects. So what I tried to do is use the Dada publications to show two things. First, how these publications document the more ephemeral aspects of Dada. So we have programs of performances, catalogs of exhibitions, posters for coming events, leaflets that they would scatter on the streets, and so on. And second, I try to show how the Dadaists used their publications to spread the Dada movement from Switzerland to every corner of Europe and elsewhere. So that's why the exhibition is titled Documenting Dada, Disseminating Dada. And as far as favorite pieces, that's really a hard one. I suppose my favorites are those that show off the Dadaists' masterful use of innovative typography and page layout, because that was really one of their hallmarks. Among the pieces that are in the exhibition, I think one that I'd single out is the poster or announcement that Kurt Schwitters and Theo van Doesburg designed for a series of Dada performances in the Netherlands. It's considered by many to be the masterpiece of Dada typography. Then there are some wonderful page spreads from the New York magazine called 291 and its successor, which was Francis Picabia's 391, that all have amazingly creative intermingling of text and image, which is another Dada hallmark. Then there's the Romanian publication called 75 HP, 75 horsepower, which presents something that editors call pictopoesie, which is a combination of poetry and painting. You know, you just have to come and see them, or look at the images online at least.
So what are the gallery hours, and how can folks get more details?
Gallery hours are 9 to 6, and it's on display through April 28th in the gallery at the main library of the University of Iowa. It's free and open to the public. And then you can see highlights of the exhibition online, sort of a sampling of what's on display, if you go to the library's webpage, lib.uiowa.edu, you know, you'll find a very prominent link to the exhibition. You can't miss it. And Andrei Codrescu was here about a month ago. He gave a wonderful talk, almost more a performance than a talk. And, of course, he's a Romanian-American poet who, like one of the founders of Dada, Tristan Tzara, remade himself into, in his case, an American poet. Tristan Tzara became a French poet. And he wrote a book called The Posthuman Dada Guide. So his talk was sort of a spin-off from that book. And you can find links to the whole talk on our webpage, and it's on YouTube.
Curator of the International Dada Archive at the University of Iowa Library Special Collections, Dr. Tim Scheib. Be sure to head to the University of Iowa Main Library in Iowa City before April 28th to view the exhibit or check it out online. The Des Moines Arts Center has on display through May 5th, Alchemy, Transformations, and Gold. Davenport's Putnam Museum is presenting the Magical History Tour, a Beatles exhibition now through June 4th. And Football and American Art, from the Civil War to the Present, will be exhibited through May 14th at the Figge in Davenport. In honor of Holocaust Remembrance Day this month, there will be many special programs. On April 4th, UNI Center for Holocaust and Genocide Education will present Holocaust survivor Peter Gorog at UNI's Curris Business Building. On April 18th and 24th, the Ames Public Library will present programs from the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. On April 2nd and 9th, the Figge will present documentaries. Waterloo's Grout Museum District and UNI Center for Holocaust and Genocide Education are presenting Facing Prejudice and Dr. Seuss Wants You, April 4th through June 3rd. On April 23rd, Davenport's Temple Emmanuel will offer a Holocaust remembrance service. And on April 24th, the UNI Center for Holocaust and Genocide Education will also hold a Day of Remembrance ceremony at the Sullivan Brothers Iowa Veterans Museum's Mess Hall in Waterloo. Just ahead, we'll get the inside scoop from IPR's Tony Daner on the 2017 Mission Creek Festival in Iowa City. We'll applaud the University of Iowa's Opera for their upcoming productions of Pirates of Penzance. And we'll hear about an exciting artist-in-residence program at Iowa State. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
It's been just a great experience. I think art enriches our lives in ways that sometimes we don't understand. And the more we can engage people through art, I think the better off our world will be.
And Iowa State has been doing portraiture actively since the 1930s. It was President Raymond Hughes who began this on kind of a fast pace in the 30s and 40s, and he began this at the depth of the Depression, and it was to honor the traditions and the people who have made contributions. And President Hughes also encouraged the deans to do portraits of deans, of vice presidents, of distinguished professors, and alumni. So actually, it is an 80-plus year tradition that we've been doing at Iowa State.
Dr. Wendy Winterstein, Dean of the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, and Lynette Pohlman, the Director and Chief Curator of the University Museums at Iowa State. Starting with a large canvas and continuing at the Iowa State Fair, ISU initiated an awesome project called Portraits of Iowa State, utilizing the talents of Maquoketa artist Rose Franson. Lynette and Wendy share background on how ISU's Portraits of Iowa State project got started.
I think it began when the College of Ag and Life Sciences asked Rose to do a wonderful portrait of Henry Wallace and George Washington Carver. And that's been several years ago. And Rose worked with the college and its faculty and with Marcia and Jim Burrell to conceive of this wonderful portrait, and it's large. And it has not only portraiture in it, but landscapes and science and technology. And it was such a powerful portrait that Rose went to our hearts at that point in time. That was kind of quickly followed by another posthumous portrait of Floyd Andre, former dean of the College of Agriculture. And so when we thought about what was Iowa State going to do for the beautiful adventure show, it was all about our beautiful campus. And then we thought, but it's the people who make it beautiful too. And then how could we incorporate that into an expression at the state fair? And so we called up Rose. I mean, it was rather casual and one of those meant to be, and said, "Rose, what do you think? Are you in?" And she said she was in, and then Wendy really helped us bring all of the deans together and administrators, so it was a shared project across campus.
And I would say that the experience we had with Rose Franson was almost spiritual. When she came and shared with us her vision for what this portrait of Henry A. Wallace and George Washington Carver would be, I remember sitting in the room and just shivers running down my spine. She had captured the concept of how to present their relationship in a way that I think for generations to come, they'll see what it means to have a mentor, to welcome diversity into your family, to find that commonality between two individuals that really are from such different backgrounds. So Rose was just a rock star for us when it came to this portrait. And then the opportunity to have her do these Faces of Iowa State at the State Fair was phenomenal. And I have to tell you, all the deans came on board. So I think their engagement as the process went on really deepened. And I think their happiness with the outcome is just off the chart.
Wendy remarks how Rose's many talents have added to their Portrait of Iowa State project.
Well, Rose is phenomenal. And her ability to sit down and understand, first of all, the individuals that she's going to be working with, I think is an important part of what happens. When she was working on the big portrait of Carver and Wallace, the amount of research she did and the conversations that she had with our faculty and staff so that she really understood about these men before she painted them. And in the end, Rose taught us things about Carver and Wallace that we didn't know, and that was very meaningful to us. When we think about her work with these Faces of Iowa State University, Rose is one of the most engaging individuals I've ever met. So you sit down an individual who's going to have his or her portrait done by Rose, and Rose immediately starts a conversation with them. And how does she do this? I can't imagine how she does it. So she's painting, doing this incredible piece of artwork, and at the same time, so engaged with the individual that she's painting. So they develop a relationship in that four-hour time period, a relationship I believe that they won't ever forget. And I think that was demonstrated when she started this concept with the Faces of Maquoketa, Iowa, that were exhibited at the National Gallery. But this community of these people and their faces that she painted, what an incredible story.
Last summer, Rose Franson wowed audiences at the Iowa State exhibit at the Iowa State Fair. Over a nine-day period, Rose painted the portraits of 19 Iowa Staters. Lynette and Wendy reveal the next exciting chapter happening now in the ISU portrait saga.
It was an amazing process for young and old, and we limited it just to 4 hours per sitter. And so they're all gesture and they all have this same kind of quickness, and Rose was able to capture the essence of the person. First time she'd met most of these people, and yet she captured that in those 4 hours, and the audience was awed by watching her paint, because Rose is painting and talking to the sitter, sometimes talking to the audience. Children were captivated. Children were actually sit and watch the longest of any of them. It's amazing to see this transformation from a white canvas to a fully expressed portrait that really does look like people and has their character and their spirit in the portrait as well.
So now you are morphing ahead from the State Fair, and you have this next project, which you are getting more people signed up. Tell us about your next painting schedule.
Well, it goes through April 6th. And as Wendy said, some of this is the deans and the campus was so excited about the State Fair, we decided that this would be a great thing to share with the citizens of Iowa. So we're going to paint another 13 portraits and then exhibit all of them in the Brunier beginning in August through the semester. And then beginning in January of 2018, we'll start a 2-year tour to several Iowa sites, 5 or 6 different sites around the state of Iowa.
I have a really special story about 2 of the additional portraits that will be done. You know, you try to describe to somebody what's going to happen, and they think oftentimes of a formal portrait like we might have of the president of the university. So I took a very well done copy of one of the beautiful portraits, actually, of Joe Lyon, and to show to this couple so they could understand what it was that they would be sitting for. And they, of course, agreed, wanted to participate, are going to participate. But then at the end of the day, they said, well, we'd like to keep this copy of Joe Lyon's portrait. And I said, oh, you know Joe. And they said, no, we just think it's so beautiful. So to me, that was just a real indication of how well done these faces of Iowa State are.
Mm-hmm. There's going to be a painting this afternoon. Tell us who some of these people are that folks can drop in and see the painting happen.
There's a schedule that people can find if they go to the museum's website, museums.iastate.edu. One will be Lori Jacobson. Lori was the first student worker who worked at the Brunier Gallery beginning in about 1976. And since then, she's maintained a 40-year relationship with us. She went on to be a museum professional and has done many things for us. She lives in California, and she's a native of Roland, Iowa. And she's going to be coming back, and we're going to honor Lori because she's just been so pivotal from the very beginning to the university museums and has been so thoughtful in her professional support of us.
That on April 5th, Jane Ann Stout will have her portrait painted. Jane Ann Stout served as the Associate Dean and Director for Families Extension, so she's known throughout the state for her work with families and youth. And she was also a faculty member in the College of Design and very much involved in the university museums. Her love of art and art education made her just a perfect candidate for her participation in this effort.
I loved calling these people to ask them if they would participate. The museum didn't have anyone in the State Fair group, so I kind of wanted to get in on the fun with the deans. And so when I called some people to see if they would join in, invariably everyone was stunned. They were silent. They didn't know what to say. And when they gathered themselves up, they always thought it was such an honor. And of course, they all said, why me? And you tell them why. And it was just such a joyous thing to extend that from Iowa State to these people who have been such engaged participants of Iowa State for so long. Just a joy. And we have a news release for you because Rose is going to do her self-portrait. And we haven't announced that yet. And so that is going to also take place before April 6th. Rose hasn't decided exactly when her own 4-hour time slot is, but we'll let that come out as well. And I think there will be students in particular who will want to come watch Rose do a self-portrait. That's another talent in itself, is to paint yourself as well as someone else.
So how can folks find where this is going to happen on campus? What building, and how do they get to it?
This will happen in Morrill Hall. It will be in the Ryman Gallery in the Christian Peterson Art Museum. That's on the lower level of Morrill Hall. for those people who come to Iowa State, we advise them to park in the Memorial Union parking ramp and then walk 2 blocks through a lovely campus that will be flowering and gorgeous at that time, and then come into the museum. It will be there from about 10 until 6. And I would instruct people to go to the website to get the details of the sitters and the specific times. And the website is museumsiastate.edu.
How is this going to be set up?
It'll take the lower gallery, which is about 1,000 square feet. Rose will be set up. She will have the sitter in a chair. She'll have a mirror behind her. The sitters will actually see their portrait evolve, and we'll have chairs for other people to sit in, and I imagine they'll just be chatting with Rose and with the sitter as goes along, and they can come and go. They can come for 20 minutes or 10 minutes, or they could stay a little bit longer if they liked. And it's free and open to the public. We'd love to have the citizens of Iowa come and visit us.
I want to tell one more story, and that's about Marcia and Jim Burrell when they provided us with the gift to have the Wallace Carver portrait done. And when we selected Rose as one possible artist, Lynette provided several alternatives for us to consider. Again, it was one of those special moments because Marcia Burrell's mother, her portrait had been painted as part of the Faces of Maquoketa, Iowa. And so to have this kind of nice connection back into time, again, was another special moment. And then, of course, Marcia had had her own experiences at the State Fair as the president of the State 4-H Council back in, I think, 1975, and had been at the fair with the president. And so there was this nice symmetry that was occurring in so many different ways as we've worked through the project.
And I think Iowa State is so grateful to so many people who have contributed to Iowa State. And this is one small way that we can say, we really value you. These are 34 portraits. There are over 600,000 people that should be having their portrait done. So be that as it may, they're all Iowa Staters or friends or family, alumni, and we're thrilled that we could do these 34. I hope it's only the beginning of more to come.
Dr. Wendy Winterstein, Dean of the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, and Lynette Pohlman, the Director and the Chief Curator at the University Museums at Iowa State. Hats off to Iowa State for recognizing their students, faculty, staff, alumni, and friends with such a creative portrait legacy for the university and for the state. For more details on Rose Franson, go to oldcityhallgallery.com and also listen to IPR's March of 2016 Iowa Art Showcase Rose Franson interview. This weekend marks Iowa Public Radio's Arias in April series, featuring operas from the Des Moines Metro Opera, the UNI Opera Theater, and Cedar Rapids Opera Theater. Tonight at 8 and again Sunday evening at 11, listen to Iowa Public Radio Classical for the Des Moines Metro Opera's production of Verdi's Falstaff, starring Iowa natives Wayne Tigges and Chris Carr. And it's still not too late to donate to Iowa Public Radio's Silent Spring Pledge Drive. Our goal is to raise $385,000 by Tuesday without interrupting programming. Make your pledge online today at iowapublicradio.org. Don't go away. We'll delight as a flock of beautiful maidens, a bevy of boisterous bobbies, and a pack of swashbuckling pirates invade Hanscher Auditorium. And IPR's Tony Daner explores this year's magnificent literary, musical, and culinary Mission Creek Festival offerings. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
Festival every year, you know, we really just want to find ways for people to engage with art, which we think is awesome, but to also engage with the folks in their community. We're just trying to get people to engage with each other, to engage with work, and to hopefully push our community forward just by getting all of us in the same room, which is tough to do. Students are busy, you know, families are busy, work, you know, takes up a lot of time. So it's like, how can we create these spaces and events that allow us to unplug and replug back into the world in a different sort of positive way outside of our usual flow?
That's Andre Perry, festival director of the Mission Creek Music and Arts Festival in Iowa City. This is the 12th year for the festival, which begins on April 4th and runs through the 9th. Mission Creek presents a variety of artistic experiences through music, literature, stand-up comedy, and other art forms. Andre tells us about the festival's origins and purpose.
It began, this version, in Iowa City back in 2006. And from the beginning, this festival was about this crossover between different mediums of art that could exist. And we started with music and we started with literature, and we said, hey, Iowa City has a great music scene. People love music, love attending shows. And there's also a big writing culture because of the university and what it offers in that regard. And so we put the two together, and, you know, it was a 4-day festival. Now it's evolved over the last decade into a 6-day festival. And our focus is performance, literature, and community. And it's going to occur over 6 days across a lot of different venues in downtown Iowa City. Some of the classic traditional venues that people would see shows in, like the Englert Theater, the Mill, Gabe's, the Yacht Club, as well as some other places like Perry Lights and some restaurants that get involved that have like cool culinary events, but also will have performances happening within them, as well as some other retail. And this year, we're seeing a little bit of expansion because Hancher Auditorium at the University of Iowa came back online. And so we're going to be working with them on a couple events. And additionally, we're going to be working with Big Grove Brewery, which is a Iowa homegrown brewery. They will also be hosting a couple events as well. And so just seeing that expansion into these spaces that make up the cultural geography of downtown Iowa City.
I've taken a look at the lineup, both of musicians and authors, and there certainly is a, I don't know if it's a concerted effort to get Iowa-based or at least folks with an Iowa connection, but that's definitely there in the lineup.
We try to have a balance across many different sorts of artists. We definitely want to represent across artistic, you know, landscape folks who are making awesome art in the state of Iowa, particularly with the bands. You know, we definitely have a lot of bands who come through who are making music in Des Moines or Cedar Falls or in Iowa City, and then some folks from more rural parts of the state, trying to get them in here and be a part of the festival. Because part of the thing is that we want to open up the conversation where you have these local and regional bands that are in conversation with national and even international acts that come in from all over the country, all over the world. And that's just part of what we offer is, what is it like to play in an intimate venue with a band that you might have loved, you know, for like 10 or 15 years? What does it mean to, you know, open up for one of those artists or to be in the same dressing room? And then, you know, in the best case scenario, a connection develops between, you know, an artist who's from the state and someone who's from out of the state. And the next thing you know, maybe they're going on tour together or they're working on a record together, or maybe it's two writers who meet through the literary program.
As with every year, this year's Mission Creek music lineup includes a wide variety of artists representing many genres. This year's festival will include performances on opening night and the final night by two of alternative music's best-known violin players.
Our big headliner this year is Andrew Bird. And that's a collaboration that's really important to us because we're bringing Andrew in to perform at Hancher Auditorium, which was initially flooded out in 2008. And so they just rebuilt this building on the campus of the University of Iowa next to the Iowa River. It's a beautiful, beautiful, modern space-age hall. And so Andrew with My Brightest Diamond is going to be playing. And that's the opening ceremony of the festival. We're also collaborating with Scope, which is the student programming team at the University of Iowa. So it's kind of like everyone got involved to kind of be all hands-on to have this opening event. And so we're just happy to like have this event in Hancher, a space that means so much to us. And, you know, it's just kind of a new beginning for Iowa City. So that's a really special kind of emotional opening ceremony for Mission Creek this year.
She will notice you and your ex. could chew. You need a witness to know you're there.
We also have folks like Kishibashi, who's played the festival before and put on what is now a legendary performance at the Mill about 3 or 4 years ago. And he's going to come and he's going to be the closing performance of the festival at the Englert Theater.
Would you be everything I wanted, and a lover and an accomplice? Could you be her? Would you feel together and inebriated, enabling of a fable we were never meant to be, but together? Did you mean to misinterpret images of our innocence and vestiges of virtue? Would you feel pity for the masses who were adding and subtracting with scandals that we made together?
This year's music lineup also includes nationally known artists like Tennis, Cloud Nothings, and Bridget Kearney, along with Iowa musicians Elizabeth Moen, Sires, and Pieta Brown. Alternative literature is another key component of the Mission Creek Festival. The philosophy towards putting together the literature lineup is similar to that of the music lineup.
This festival, I think, really wants to be the home for the independent literary world, where folks whose voices aren't necessarily heard in the mainstream, whether it's by design through what they do, or if they're just kept out of the mainstream, you know, if they're voices of color, if they're queer voices, if they're women's voices that don't get through some of the publishing world's editing process. So we want to make sure that there are voices heard through that literary space, and we want to be the home for those independent writers and readers and the publishers. And then the community aspect is, you know, kind of like our third foundation, which is all about, we just want to make sure there's an opportunity, whether, you know, you don't need to be into Margaret Cho or you don't need to be into Andrew Bird, but we want every citizen who's in this space to have ownership of this festival. So there's a lot of free program we do on that, our community day, which is on Saturday, April 8th. Where there's shows happening, there's a book fair, there's a comics and zine fair, there's a lot of cheap food. Just trying to make it as easy as possible for someone just to roll into downtown Iowa City, have an experience with art, and have a great day, and feel happy and feel connected to the community.
Joe Tiefenthaler is one of the Mission Creek programming directors, specializing in the literary schedule. He talks about some of this year's major literary events.
The literary lineup of Mission Creek Festival, you know, has really grown into, you know, that its own skin in a way of, you know, focusing on, you know, what is a really dynamic and vibrant, independent and emerging publishing scene across the country. The week really kicks off, you know, there inside the Hancher Building with a reading from an author in Kelly Link that is really one of our generation's great short story writers. She writes in magic realism, science fiction, and fantasy. You know, her books are incredible. Stories are just so incredible. We're excited to have her here in front of the community for the first time ever. And then on Thursday at Prairie Lights, we are, you know, welcoming back to town a nonfiction writing program graduate student in Kristen Radke. She is publishing a graphic memoir and is coming out for the festival. Date specifically, it's called Imagine Only Wanting This, or Imagine Wanting Only This. And it's anticipated to be one of the bigger books of the year. And this is the first chance that anybody will really get to see her read this live.
This year also marks the 7th year of Mission Creek's Lit Crawl.
The Lit Crawl is kind of our manic way of throwing around, you know, anywhere between 60 to 75 dynamic voices. Everybody gets about, you know, 5 to 7 minutes. It is a literary tour of, you know, some of those boutique and non-traditional spaces of Iowa City, where we schedule in. There's 4 readings at the 5 o'clock hour, 3 readings at the 6 o'clock hour, and then 2 readings at the 7. And, you know, the literary crowd builds and moves on, and you see people walking the streets, finding that next venue, seeing that next poet, or, you know, catching their friend read their little bit of an essay that was published somewhere. So it's kind of it's a crazy evening, and, you know, a really great way to come out and see some and a lot of really incredible writing.
There are some literary events happening throughout the week at the festival, but April 8th, the community day, that seems to be the big day for literature.
It is. It's a really core day for literature, and it really kind of starts with that book fair, which was one of the, I think, the earliest things that we programmed when we really built out the literary edge of the festival, of, you know, bringing in some of the publishers, incredible like poetry publishers, fiction publishers, literary magazines that were really putting out amazing work. It was our way to start seeding, you know, the literary community in this festival. And so there is a book fair where you'll be able to come in and see these handmade books from Spork Press out of Tucson, Arizona. One of my favorite poetry publishers in the country in Black Ocean, coming from Boston. There are publishers from throughout the Midwest coming. There's a really wonderful boutique literary, but, you know, poetry magazine called Forklift Ohio. These guys always come from Cincinnati. Saraband Books, which is kind of gradually becoming a major force on the upper end of the independent publishing scene. They're coming out to sell their essays and poetry. So that's really a big, that's a really big day. And that was, you know, almost the heart of where the programming builds. There's going to be one reading, you know, at Prairie Lights there at the noon hour, which is a poet's Cole Swenson and Shane McCrae coming together to read the poetry of Kokoi Guevara, a student who had gone through the workshop and was in the process of publishing the book and then kind of just tragically passed away. And so this will be the first time a lot of us will be able to hear those poems. And it's really wonderful that such people like Cole and Shane are able to come out and read those words for us. And after that, there's a series of events as part of Community Day that we call Mission Boutique. There's one author and one band. You get, you know, about 15 minutes or so of each, and they just run through, you know, three different boutiques, just crawling you again, you know, the back way through Iowa City. Some great writers on that bill. Danielle Dutton, who's just a really wonderful voice. She's coming up from St. Louis. Nat Baldwin, who's also a musician. His first book just came out, and so he'll be reading from that. And then Jack Gems, one of my favorites from Chicago. She's come out to Mission Creek a number of times, and she's got a new book coming out. So this is a chance where we're getting to hear a lot of new words.
Joe also talks about various collaborations happening on Community Day and what he calls guest curators.
Where, you know, we reach out to a poet and literary figure like Saeed Jones, who runs BuzzFeed Books, you know, coming out with a couple of writers that he thinks, you know, are important to the community in Isaac Fitzgerald and Alice Sola Kim, both young authors just with incredible young voices, really doing some good work, bringing in Lambda Literary, which is a nonprofit organization that hosts residencies and awards and really represents the queer literature scene. We're just working with people in organizations like Young Chicago Authors who will come down from Chicago and they'll have workshops with local young writers. And then those young authors will actually get their own reading as part of our Friday Lit Crawl. So we're really, really ecstatic to bring in some flavors from other cities, other areas, other communities, and then having them work with local authors and ingraining things like that Lit Crawl with authors from both from the community and then the MFA programs and some undergraduate authors that week as well.
This year's Mission Creek Festival will also include stand-up comedy performances by Margaret Cho, Michelle Wolf, and Janelle James, along with technology and community events. Some Mission Creek events do require tickets. To see the complete festival schedule and purchase tickets, visit missioncreekfestival.com. For Iowa Public Radio, I'm Tony Daner.
Binomial theorem, I'm teeming with a lot of news. News. It's a really exciting time for everybody in the School of Music. You know, we have the new Voxman School of Music building, which has been great to get to learn as we moved in last fall. It's just an amazing space for all of us to be back together again. And now to do our first opera in the New Hampshire this spring is thrilling. We've been waiting for a very long time for this. I actually, back as a guest director, directed two operas in the Old Hampshire. Did a Magic Flute and a La Boheme back before the flood. So it's really exciting to go back and be a part of this New Hampshire and do the first opera in the brand New Hampshire. And we tried to figure out what would be the right show to do to really bring the public in and be a great introduction to opera. And it just seemed like the smartest choice was to do Gilbert and Sullivan's The Pirates of Penzance. And I always love sharing it with audiences because Gilbert and Sullivan, done well, really smartly, really cleanly, there's just nothing quite like it. And to share that information with a lot of our cast who have not been exposed to Gilbert and Sullivan before has really been thrilling because it's a really important thing. Opera companies around the country and around the world are doing Gilbert and Sullivan all the time, more and more these days. Operetta is a tricky thing because there is some dialogue. I mean, it's primarily sung. Operetta, as we know it, the Gilbert and Sullivan operettas and the French operettas are really the precursor to the Broadway shows as we know them today. They incorporated dialogue, and the singers really have to be able to be a triple threat. They have to sing really well. They have to be able to do dialogue, to act the dialogue, and there's also a lot of movement in a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta, a lot of dance, a lot of musical staging. So it's really more than just a stand and sing kind of opera. Doing operetta is really a challenging thing, and I think it's really important for our students to learn the art of the operetta, to be able to take that with them as they go out into their professional careers. And as we know, many operas, many grand operas do not have a happy ending. Someone dies or something terrible happens. And we wanted this to be a true celebration of our first opera in the New Hampshire and something that would really be celebratory. You know, so Pirates seemed like the perfect ticket. So the Pirates of Penzance was really the right ticket to celebrate this brand new facility that we have and the Opera Theater Department at the University of Iowa at this time.
Bill Tyson, University of Iowa's Associate Professor and Director of Opera. This is Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. Before heading to the University of Iowa 4 years ago, Bill served as an artistic director and a freelance director across the United States. He spent a lot of time appreciating the musicianship and wit of Gilbert and Sullivan operettas.
The canon of Gilbert and Sullivan work, it's so strong, and Pirates is almost 140 years old, so it holds up incredibly well when you think of some pieces that were written maybe 20 or 30 years ago that don't really hold up that well. One interesting fact about Pirates is it was the first opera of theirs to ever premiere in New York City. All the other ones, obviously, had premiered in England, in their home. And HMS Pinafore was the collaboration right before Pirates of Penzance, and it was such a hit, and it came over, and there were so many pirated versions of HMS Pinafore in America that Gilbert and Sullivan decided to kind of beat that trend and open Pirates of Penzance in New York City itself. So it was the first time that had ever happened. And their welcoming to New York was unbelievable. When they came across the Atlantic Ocean, it was really an amazing thing, and some historians have said that not until the Beatles was there that sort of a welcome for British musicians in America.
So they were afraid that their pirates would be pirated.
Exactly, and that's another great fact. One of the reasons they chose Pirates of Penzance as their follow-up collaboration to HMS Pinafore was because there had been so many pirate versions of that show, so I think it was very much a tongue-in-cheek reference to what had happened to their previous work.
And as you said, tongue-in-cheek, that's another thing that I think is so timeless about this, is how their sense of humor and sort of making fun at different parts of society and all of that's all wrapped up into this.
Very much so. They were really fearless. They poked fun at a lot of people that were running England at the time and a lot of the aristocracy and the royalty, and they really were equal opportunity. They loved to parody things, and they really were experts at the world of parody. And what I have told the cast here is we have to perform this incredibly sincerely. The humor in any Gilbert and Sullivan work really comes from us truly believing this. If we try to add our parody onto their parody, it gets weighed down. We have to treat this with great respect because what they wrote holds up so well today and is really a very delicate thing. Operetta is a really light thing. You have to keep it floating and keep it right up there in the air so that it keeps moving along and the audience goes right with you on that ride.
So the pirates, it was a definite professional career path. And people had to be serious about this when they go into this.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you really have to get the sense of that. The stakes have to be very high, I think. Otherwise, the comedy does not play. We have to really believe in this. And for instance, the lead character, Frederick, the piece is called The Pirates of Penzance, and they often had a second title. So this is The Pirates of Penzance or The Slave of Duty. And The Slave of Duty is the character of Frederick, who is turning 21 and has been an apprentice with the pirates, and now on his 21st birthday is deciding that he is going to leave the band of pirates, very much to their chagrin. So that sense of duty is a really important part for him, and that seriousness. He's really quite a serious fellow and wants to try and find his way. And finding that, there has to be an honest, sincere sense of duty for him to really make it work. We can't be winking ourselves at what they were already winking at. And the other amazing trait of more Sullivan than Gilbert and many composers, this is the mid to late 1800s when they were doing the bulk of their writing, and so many composers of that time were borrowing from each other. You can hear different things in Pirates. There certainly are nods to Puccini. There's nods to many other composers. And Gilbert, as the composer of the music, really did borrow freely from many composers of the day. Offenbach, the French composer who wrote a lot of operetta also. There's a lot of his work in there. But then, interestingly enough, it went back and forth because other composers really borrowed from Sir Arthur Sullivan as well when they were writing their things. So back in that time, it was, I wouldn't want to say a free-for-all, but it went back and forth. There was a great impression, especially in England and in Italy and France and Germany. A lot of those composers really listened to each other and learned from each other. And I think that Sir Arthur Sullivan was probably the top of that list.
Give us, in a nutshell, a synopsis of this and then some of the highlights of it.
Well, I talked about Frederick, who is the young apprentice to the band of pirates of Penzance. And on his 21st birthday, he kind of shocks them, saying, I'm going to go off on my own way. And then we learn from his nursemaid, Ruth, who is the only woman on this entire ship of pirates, that she was supposed to apprentice him to a pilot, not a pirate. Gilbert loved to do that word play, so he realizes that he really wasn't supposed to be in with this group of pirates. So he leaves, and Ruth wants him to take her with him and marry him because she's the only woman that he has known. But then he sees this group of young girls and says, oh my gosh, Ruth is old. I need to meet with one of these young girls. And he meets Mabel, who is one of these daughters of the Major General, and they fall in love. So we meet the Major General, who is basically every GNS opera has a man called the Patter Man, who sings songs with very quick lyrics and what they call a patter song, very, very fast lyrics and a lot of words. And he is the father of all these young girls. And the pirates come back and they decide they want to marry the daughters. But the Major General is not really in favor of that, so he tells a bit of a lie to get out of that one. And then in Act Two, he admits that he had lied to the pirates and he's feeling very guilty about it. And the pirates learn of his lie and decide to come back and rob his mansion and take the daughters with him. And a big battle ensues, and we kind of learn the true story about the pirates, and we get to a happy ending. But it's delightful. There's the Pirates of Penzance, the group of pirates, the daughters of the Major General, all the wards of his, the young ladies. And then in Act Two, we meet the police, the bobbies of the day, who are going to battle with the pirates. Frederick and the Major General call the police in to help them to save the daughters from the pirates. So it really is comic opera at its best.
And it sounds like you have a rather large cast.
We do. We have a cast of 24, which is exciting to kind of fill up the Hampshire stage. And then we have, of course, the full orchestra conducted by Maestro William LaRue Jones, which is thrilling to have him involved as well as the orchestra in Hampshire. And Margaret Wenk, who does many of our sets here at the University of Iowa, pretty much all of them is the set design for this. And costumes are being coordinated by she and Cindy Kubu in the costume department. And we have a guest from the theater department, Brian Wynn, who is our lighting designer. So it's going to be a really fine-looking production.
Well, and just to be on the Hancher stage, I think that's going to be really exciting for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, everyone has seen things there and different concerts and things since they've opened last fall. And every time I go and see something, I think I cannot wait for the students to get the opportunity to be in this incredible new facility and to do something as fun and as crowd-pleasing as Pirates of Penzance.
So what are some of those favorite highlights people will enjoy?
Well, gosh, Mabel's first aria is called Poor Wandering One, which is a delightful tune that she sings when she first meets Frederick, and she's sort of chastising her sister, saying, look at this poor man, he's trying to find his way, and we have to be kind to him. Probably the most famous tune in the operetta that we would know here in America today is called With Cat-Like Tread, and what we would know it today, the words are not this in the opera, but it would be, hail, hail, the gang's all here, da-da-da-da-da-da. The words are different, but that tune was originated in the Pirates of Penzance. It's when the pirates come back to rob the Major General's home that they sing, come, friends who plow the sea. It's all about the pirates, but that tune is from the Pirates of Penzance. That's probably the most familiar one, the most popular one from the Pirates of Penzance.
Well, it definitely sounds like a lot of fun. So how can folks get more info, get tickets, find out all the details?
Tickets are now available at the Hancher box office. You can call the box office if you like, and that number is 319-335-1160. Or you can go online to the Hancher website, which is Hancher/tickets, and they have information there. There's also a lot of information on our School of Music website, the University of Iowa School of Music website. The best bet probably is to go to Hancher. They have all the information, and they have the ticket availability. And like I said, it's the perfect show for all ages. It's a great show for kids. I know we do two performances. One is on Friday evening, April 21st at 7:30 p.m. And then the second performance is on Sunday, April 23rd. It's a 2 o'clock matinee, and that's listed as a family day. So we're encouraging, I mean, you know, certainly families can come to either performance, but the Sunday matinee is a family day, and I think it would be a great time to bring kids out. And kids, or anyone who hasn't experienced opera before, this is the perfect first opera. It's very accessible. It's very funny. It's got great tunes, and I think it would be a really wonderful introduction to anyone who hasn't seen an opera before. And to opera and Gilbert and Sullivan lovers, it's one of the favorites.
University of Iowa's Associate Professor and Director of Opera, Bill Tyson. The ISU Opera Studio will present a performance on April 13th at the Martha Ellen Tai Recital Hall. The UNI Opera Theater will present Death by Aria on April 24th at Davis Hall. And UNI's Chloe documentary film series featuring Abigail Disney will be held on April 24th and 25th. The Iowa Art Showcase broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Program thanks for this show goes to Tim Scheib, Lynette Pullman, Wendy Winterstein, Tony Daner, Joe Tiefenthaler, Andre Perry, and Bill Tyson. Production thanks goes to Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner, Phil Moss, Catherine Perkins, Jim Davies, Emily Woodbury, and Sean McLean. Operations thanks for this show also goes to IPR's Jason Burns, Sean McLean, Nick Brinks, and music director Al Scherz. Program research was provided by Rachel Berenger and Nick Schumacher. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. Thanks for joining us. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org.